This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. Coming up in just about 2 weeks from now, it's going to be another Gary International Black Film Festival happening on the IU Northwest campus in Gary. Some great films to be shown this year, as always, and we have with us the founder of the Gary International Black Film Festival, Karen Toering. Karen, thanks for joining us on Regionally Speaking today. If you will, tell us, for folks that are not familiar with what the Gary International Black Film Festival is, how it got started, and the types of films that people get to see when they come to campus this year.
Okay. The Gary International Black Film Festival is literally that. It's a film festival that features films that are either by or about black people across in the United States and across the diaspora. And it was founded, this is our eighth year, so I cannot believe that we've been actually able to do this for the last 7 years, so we're pretty excited about this year. It's a three-day event with films beginning on Friday and running all the way through Sunday, Friday, October the 12th, through Sunday, October 14th, and it's an opportunity to really just take a deep dive into films, films about documentaries, you know, about things and people and events that happened with, you know, within our time and history, dramatic films that are feature really great storytelling, funny films that, you know, are about the quirky ways that life kind of gets at us, and just an opportunity to see some really good film, what, craftsmanship, for lack of a better term. Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
I know that it's always been, now with this upcoming 8th annual festival, that it's always been an opportunity not only to showcase independent black film activity that may come in, but in particular here in Northwest Indiana and the city of Gary, mainly because I know it's always been the effort to be able to help build a very vibrant and very active film-going community, not only those attending films, but those who make it.
That's the nice part about it, I think. One of the things that we did when we founded the film festival was very much intentionally made it an opportunity not only to see a film, but also to have a conversation about it, right? Mm-hmm. So we bring in filmmakers who are, you know, some of them are emerging, some of them are really well established. A few years ago, we had Robert Townsend, who has made a really funny film called Hollywood Shuffle.
Oh,
and
yes.
He came to town. Yeah, remember that film?
Oh, yes. It was a great film.
And but he had another film that he had done about a boys' school in the near South, like South Carolina or something like that. And, you know, he's a filmmaker. He, you know, just because you made one film doesn't mean you stop. And so, you know, we also have filmmakers that no one's ever heard of, at least not yet. And to me, that's the exciting part about it, the opportunity to talk to an emerging filmmaker, you know, about their film, and then just sort of watch their career, you know, as they continue to make film, as they continue to do media. And I think that's what people like the most about the film festival.
And I know, too, part of the project itself is not only giving folks here a chance to see some great films that they may not see anyplace else, but it gives folks in Northwest Indiana and the city of Gary in particular a chance to get involved in actually making those films, and businesses supporting those filmmakers, too, I understand, mm-hmm. because a lot of businesses and a lot of nonprofits get very much involved in this, I understand.
Yeah, they do. We offered this opportunity. You know, we were trying to think of ways that, well, it's kind of like in the early days, just convincing people, right,
mm-hmm.
that it was worth their time to come to a film festival because, you know, it's like, well, what do you do at a film festival? Well, you watch films and you talk about them. And so, you know, as an incentive for, you know, nonprofits and educational institutions and things like that, we were like, well, you know, what if we offer the opportunity for you to receive a portion of the ticket sales. Like, you sell the tickets, you know, we, you know, give you half or a third. It just depends on what night of the film festival it is. And so then it's an opportunity for organizations to raise money and also, you know, see a film that may be about something that is really important to the work that they're doing. So nonprofits can join with us and, you know, basically host a film. And, you know, it's almost like feeding two birds with one hand. Mm-hmm. You know, not only do you raise money for your nonprofit, but, you know, the film has subject matter that is relevant to the work that you're doing. So then you get to use a different tool to get your message out. So, you know, and it's been pretty successful so far.
Now, I know that we don't have time, unfortunately, in our conversation today to go through all of the films. There are more than 40 short and feature-length films that are going to be involved in the festival. We should mention, though, that you can take a look at the full schedule on the website at GaryBlackFilmFest.com. And you can also go on that link as well, too, and get your tickets for the event. Let's talk about some of these major films that you're going to be bringing in particular, the opening night film, the red carpet reception, of course, gives folks a chance to have a great meal and see this very important film, which is entitled I, Angry Black Man. And tell us a little bit about the fellow who's put this together, Menelik Lumumba. What got him interested in doing a film, the topic like being an angry black man?
Well, you know, it's called One Angry Black Man, and it basically is a play on the movie 12 Angry Men. And, you know, that's sort of like a courtroom drama.
Right.
So there are a lot of things in the film that are very, if you know the original film, there are a lot of things in One Angry Black Man that are very similar to 12 Angry Men, and that was the filmmaker's homage to that film. It takes place, you know, whereas 12 Angry Men takes place mostly in that jury room, right? One Angry Black Man takes place in a college classroom. And as you go through the film, you see a lot of those, you know, sort of similar themes and narratives about one person basically fighting for their truth. And the angry part is that, you know, in a world where, you know, you're told that, you know, all you have to do is your best, and, you know, the world, you know, good things will happen to you or the world will reward you for just doing your best. It doesn't seem to be that way for this character. Mm-hmm. And the movie sort of dissects all of the reasons using history in the context of a classroom conversation that sort of, you know, lets the audience understand why this young man is angry. And it's really well done. There's some funny scenes in it. The director, this is a first-time director, Menelik Lumumba. He's actually a professor of film at Albuquerque State University, New Mexico State University in Albuquerque, New Mexico.
Oh.
And he and the cinematographer, whose name is Hans Charles, have been longtime friends. And Hans Charles is an award-winning cinematographer. In fact, he just, it was last year, won an Emmy for his work on the documentary 13th, which is about, you know, prison and the 13th Amendment. And so Hans has been doing really incredible work as a cinematographer and also teaching at NYU. And so they met basically as academics and became lifelong friends. Lumumba kept saying, you know, hey, man, one day I want to make a film. One day I want to make a film. And Hans, being, you know, the seasoned cinematographer that he was like, okay, stop saying it. and let's do it.
Well, he just wants to, turn around the expression of if one can do, they do it, and one who can't teaches. He wanted to turn that around. He wanted to reverse that completely from somebody who just teaches to somebody who actually does something. And he's certainly done very well with this one, with One Angry Black Man, that he's going to be able to show off here at IU Northwest on Friday, October 12th. I know there are always post-screening dialogues after each film is on. Will that be the case here with Mendelek's film on opening night?
Yes. In fact, Lumumba and Charles will actually join us earlier on Friday at Westside High School. They'll be talking to students, just about making a film and a career, either in film or television or media. So they're going to go over to Westside and do that Friday morning. And then they will be here for the Friday night red carpet reception and opening night. And
that's great.
It should be pretty fun.
That's great.
Well, the nice part about these two fellas is their friendship. You can see their friendship before they even enter the room. I mean, they're great friends, and they did some pretty great work.
That's wonderful. Well, as we mentioned before, there's a full schedule since there are so many films that are up on the 8th Annual Gary International Black Film Festival agenda for this year. And you can see it online on the website at GaryBlackFilmFest.com. And that's, as we mentioned, that's where you can get tickets. You can also get tickets as well, too, I guess, with the Urban League of Northwest Indiana. They have them there at the office on Broadway in Gary.
Yeah, they do. Well, they have opening night tickets, and they have full festival passes.
Oh, wonderful. So you can go make a choice. Yeah, that's right.
At the Urban League. And then, we will always have tickets at the door. So if folks want to come and see a film, and they, a lot of people don't necessarily buy tickets online, and that's why we always set aside a few tickets at the door each night for each show.
Now, we've mentioned here about the fact that the opening night red carpet reception and the film, The One Angry Black Man, is going to be shown at the IU Northwest in the Berglund Auditorium on the Gary campus. Is that the place where all of these other films are held? Or is it going to be just about every place in the campus there, and wherever they're going to have an opportunity to show a film, people can find where one is?
So, yeah, this year, thanks for asking, Chris, because this year, we're expanding our locations that will be screening films. IU has been a really strong and great partner, and using the Berglund Auditorium is a perfect size for the festival. But we also have so many films this year that entered the festival. We were like, okay, how do we, show all of this content and squeeze it all into one weekend? And so we will also be... some films will be at Indiana University Northwest. That's where opening night will be. And then on Saturday, we will have films both at Indiana University and at Art House, a social kitchen at 411 East Broadway, over on the east side.
That's great.
Indiana.
That's great. And that's a great venue to see films, too, because they've shown them there for some time since the Art House opened up. So it's going to be a great place to see some of these screenings as well, too. And as we mentioned, once again, that you can find out more about the films that are up on the 8th Annual Black Film Festival at GaryBlackFilmFest.com. And you can get the tickets available online. You can buy the tickets at the door of the various locations where films are going to be shown. And you can find out all about the films, all the ones that are going to be offered for this year's event on the website as well, too. It's always wonderful to have a chance to talk with you, Karen, because we find out more about these great things. We also find out, too, about how many people are involved in the city of Gary in not only making films, showing films, but supporting films. That's the important part of getting the whole community together for something as important as this. And so we always enjoy having a chance to talk with you. And we thank you for spending some time to go over some of the highlights of what's going to be coming up here starting on October 12th, 12th, 13th, and 14th. That is the weekend that the Gary International Black Film Festival will be held, the 8th annual such event happening in the city of Gary. And Karen Toering, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you, Chris.
It's time once again for Green Fleet Radio, and here's your host, Carl Lissick.
Well, thank you for that introduction. Today, our guest is Ms. Cynthia Maves. She's the Electric Vehicle Fleet Business Development Manager for Nissan North America. Cynthia, welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Carl.
Cynthia, I know most of our listeners know about Nissan. Can you give us a little bit of information about what you do for the company?
I focus solely on developing our electric vehicle business. So I work with fleet managers, sustainability managers, and government and corporate leaders to create awareness of the benefits of driving electric and increase adoption of our Nissan Leaf, which is a fully electric car.
So how have electric vehicles evolved over the years?
Well, back in 2010, the only two mass market electric vehicles offered were the Nissan Leaf and the Chevy Volt. Now there are so many more options for consumers. The range of the cars has increased. Battery technology is better. Also, the safety and tech features have improved dramatically over the last 8 years. In addition, there are more options in heavy and medium duty applications, such as electric garbage trucks and electric transit buses and electric bucket trucks.
Mm-hmm. So, Clean Cities is a national program that promotes all the alternative fuels, and we're a fuel-neutral organization. So why do you think an electric vehicle is good for the environment and energy security?
Well, 100% electric vehicles do not have a tailpipe, and so there are no tailpipe pollutants. Also, electric vehicles are more efficient than gas cars. So EVs convert about 60% of their electrical energy from the grid to power the wheels, whereas conventional gas vehicles only convert about 17% of the energy stored in gas to power the wheels. Also, as you know, electricity is a domestic energy source, which does help with our energy security. Typically, electricity rates are stable and don't fluctuate as much as gas prices.
Mm-hmm. So we know electric vehicle sales are at an all-time high. So what is it about electric vehicles that make them so attractive right now to buyers?
Well, the range has improved dramatically since 2010, and some of the models are affordable. In addition, the technology in electric vehicles is sophisticated and fun. As more people become aware of EVs, they're realizing that they perform better than gas cars. Fuel costs are lower. Repair and maintenance costs are also lower than gas cars. People like to plug in at home and at work and avoid the gas station. And the cars are just really fun to drive.
And they are fun to drive. You're listening to Green Fleet Radio. Our guest today is Ms. Cynthia Maves. She's the Electric Vehicle Fleet Business Development Manager for Nissan North America. So some people are concerned about powering their cars by electricity from our power plants that may result in lower greenhouse gas emissions. So what are your comments on that, Cynthia?
Well, the grid is getting cleaner through more use of energy sources such as natural gas and nuclear, hydropower, wind and solar at the power plant. And then 40% of EV drivers have solar or are considering installing solar at their home, which makes it a lot cleaner. And we're also seeing more corporations installing solar along with workplace charging.
I see. So like as an average consumer may think of electric vehicles just for their personal use, but what are some of the fleets using them as now?
We're seeing a lot more fleets adopting electric vehicles as the prices have come down. And they use them for a variety of purposes, such as security, parking enforcement, shuttle service, employee pool car delivery and IT services. And
so,
some of the examples that are fleets that have adopted electric vehicles are City of Merrillville, City of Hobart, City of Evanston in Illinois, also Indiana University. And then we've also seen utilities adopt electric vehicles such as AEP, We Energies, and Ameren Energy.
So what can we expect to see in the future from Nissan's electric vehicles? You know, I know you talked a lot about some of the new models that were coming up, but what can we expect to see from Nissan's electric vehicles?
We have a larger battery that will be offered in early 2019, and the specs and the pricing will be released later this year.
That's exciting. So how can people learn more about Nissan and their electric vehicles?
Sure. You can visit our website at nissanusa.com and click on Leaf.
So as you look at some of the drivers of your Nissan electric vehicles, so what are some of the demographics that we're seeing? Is there anything that you can talk about? You know, who is the average Nissan Leaf driver?
I think we see a variety of of drivers as an EPOM need. Certainly, we see those that are concerned about the environment, and they like the fact that it doesn't have a tailpipe and is a cleaner option than driving a gas car. Many of the drivers are techies, and they like the technology in the car, and that is one of the main reasons that they get the car. We're also seeing those drivers that want to save money on fuel and maintenance and repairs. When they do the math, it really makes sense for them and their family.
So we're hearing a lot about autonomous vehicles. You know, every day on media, you're hearing a lot about autonomous vehicles. And what's Nissan's plan for the use of autonomous vehicles in the future, if you can comment on that?
Well, Nissan's goal is zero emissions and zero fatalities. And right now, the 2018 Leaf has our ProPilot Assist technology in the car. It is not autonomous, but it is a step towards autonomous. And we will start to see that develop as we increase our technology in that area.
Very exciting. So as we come to the end of our program, do you have any closing thoughts for our listeners, Cynthia?
I would encourage your listeners to go out and take a test drive in an electric vehicle if they've never done so and really experience all of the benefits of it. It's really fun to drive. A lot of people don't realize that it's not that much different from a gas car in terms of operation. You don't have to really learn a new way to drive a car. It is a lot of fun.
And thank you for being on, and that will do it for today's edition of Green Fleet Radio. Thank you again to Cynthia Maves, Electric Vehicle Fleet Business Development Manager for Nissan North America. I'm your host, Carl Lissick. Thanks for joining us, and remember, it's never too late to begin your environmental legacy.
Green Fleet Radio is made possible by South Shore Clean Cities. You can hear Green Fleet Radio on Wednesdays here on Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio, 89.1 FM. And the podcast for Green Fleet Radio are available on our website, lakeshorepublicradio.org, as well as on NPR One. Just search for WLPR. You're listening to Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. Coming up in early November, there's going to be a very interesting series of events for an entire week at Valparaiso University, and that's going to extend as well to the city of Valparaiso. We're talking about events that include visiting scholars, panel discussions, exhibit of student photographs, a concert, and a lot more. And it's all going to be centered around Armistice Day. There's a very important reason why we are noting Armistice Day this particular year. And let's turn to attorney and organizer for some of the events for this week, Jeffrey Gettleman. Jeff, thanks for joining us on Regionally Speaking today.
My pleasure.
It's very important that people kind of figure out the context of what all of these events are all about. And since you're involved in music, and that's where the concert comes into play, but there's other events as well, too, that are tied around Armistice Day. For those of us who remember vaguely what Armistice Day is all about, because we had it in history class in school, but have probably forgotten since then, what is Armistice Day and why is Armistice Day 2018 so important?
Well, back in 1918, the armistice actually ended the hostilities. So it was kind of like a ceasefire. I know I've heard people say, well, it ended World War One, which is not technically true. The World War One didn't actually end until the Treaty of Versailles was signed, which happened about 5 or 6 months later. But, you know, on 11 p.m. on the 11th day of the 11th month, you know, there was a ceasefire. So I'm sure all the troops breathed a sigh of relief then.
Been reading in other books as well, too, since learning about it in school, yeah, there were still hostilities. There were still fighting, skirmishes that happened until the Treaty of Versailles was signed, and that actually officially ended the war. So it was just, a marker point, I suppose, of ending of hostilities overall, I would imagine.
Right. I mean, the major operations by the major players ceased at that time. So so that's why you know, people perceive it to be the end of the war. So,
and we are noting that primarily because this is the 100th anniversary of Armistice Day, the original, the very first Armistice Day.
That is correct. 100 years. So this centenary, you know, it's actually been celebrated by most of the major participants, especially in France. They had a 4-year kind of recognition of World War One, ending with this year's 100th anniversary.
Mm-hmm. I know that you're working with a lot of organizations within Porter County and many of them there at Valparaiso University to come up with this week of events. Let's go through the list, starting off with Sunday, November 4th. What is something that citizens in Northwest Indiana can get involved in that ties together with Armistice Day?
Well, what we decided to do is, and this is in connection, in collaboration with the faculty of the university and also various civic organizations in Valparaiso, we decided to each organization that's participating is going to put on a special event of some kind that relates to Armistice Day, or some of them actually are go a little beyond that or and are about a war topic in general. But the idea is that you know, all of them are free and open to the public, including the concert. And so, you know, we're hoping that everyone in the area within a reasonable driving distance finds an event that they would be particularly interested in, because obviously you have so many different academic departments and organizations participating that they all have their own little spin, their own individual spin to, you know, what they're putting on. So, you know, they range from, you know, film showings or lunches or panel discussions, and they each kind of focus on a particular topic. And, you know, all of these events are going to be, as soon as the list is absolutely finalized, which should happen soon, all the events will be publicized both in the university community and also the Valparaiso community through, you know, the city is helping out with publicizing it on all of their usual publicity channels. So everyone should be able to, you know, pick out an event that they may be interested in and visit.
We take a look here on Sunday, November 4th, as things are planned right now. It's going to be a very interesting day involving the Welcome Project at Valparaiso University. It's going to be an audio recording day, and I know that they have some big plans where they would like to talk with veterans and active duty military members. I suppose that ties in very well with Armistice Day.
I mean, one of the themes that we're trying to accomplish this week, one among several, is we're trying to show the continuity or continuum of people from the Valparaiso area, Porter County area, serving in the military, you know, all the way back 100 years ago to current veterans. And so several of the events, including the Welcome Project, are meant to help the audiences, you know, kind of connect the dots that, you know, the people, like, for instance, you know, a student veteran may be sitting next to you in English class, and, you know, he or she is, you know, has experienced the same sort of things that the person that graduated from the university 100 years ago and served in World War One did. And so we're just trying to help people bridge that, you know, that gap and understand that, you know, there are people doing the same things that happened 100 years ago.
Continuing on past the Welcome Project day that's set up for recording to talk to veterans and family members as well, too. Looking to Wednesday, November 7th, there's going to be a very interesting panel discussion come about, and it is entitled Redeployment, Finding Meaning After Armed Services. And I imagine a lot of this with the people involved who are going to be on the dais to talk with whoever's attending will have questions and probably offer some advice to the people that are in just that situation. They're coming back home after being members of the armed forces.
Right. I mean, there's quite a bit of effort, you know, being expended by, you know, all sorts of different organizations in the last several years in helping veterans who have served overseas to basically reintegrate with, you know, because the military is a totally different animal. And when you come out of it with skills, but sometimes employers don't recognize the skills you have. And sometimes, you know, you're not used to working in a civilian environment. And so, and I can tell you that from personal experience. So, the idea would be, this is the Leadership Institute at VU is putting on this panel discussion to, again, help the audience understand some of the issues that veterans who are coming back from the overseas, having served in the military, face when they come back.
We jump now to Sunday, November 11th, and this is where the concert comes in to the schedule. We understand it's going to happen at the Christopher Center. Tell us more about the idea behind the concert and how it's going. The reception for veterans will take place after that.
We've had an all-volunteer armed forces for many years now, and each year the percentage of Americans who have direct contact with the military is smaller. And so a lot of people, you know, thank me or other veterans for their service, but they don't always understand what our service was. And so we decided to approach this in a kind of a different way. So the concert is meant to honor veterans, but it's meant to honor veterans by attempting to communicate what a veteran's experience is really like, or what it has been like. And so doing it through music, of course, is on a different, totally different level than reading a newspaper article or a book. You know, it's an emotional level. And we're hoping that the audience comes away from the concert with a better understanding of what veterans actually do when they're in the service. The music itself is a variety of music by well-known composers, but the pieces themselves, because of the musical forces involved, aren't performed very much. And so this is kind of a unique opportunity for people to hear music that probably hasn't ever been performed around here and may never be again. It's kind of a unique experience. So we've tried to integrate a lot of other elements in the concert other than just music itself. So Dr. Mark Bierman, who's the provost at the university, is going to be the narrator for this concert. And we're also using other elements to engage the audience more than you would normally find at a regular, typical classical music concert. So we're hoping that the concert, the music, you know, will help get the audience thinking about things. And then afterwards, yes, you're right, the Alumni Engagement Department at the university is sponsoring a reception, which is open to anybody. But again, it's meant to honor Valparaiso University students and graduates who, you know, have served in the military, and also veterans from Porter County. So everybody's welcome to come to that reception after the concert.
Jeff, in taking a look at some of the selections that are going to be offered for the concert there on Sunday the 11th, we're talking about selections from a wide diversity of artists and composers, people like Beethoven, Richard Strauss, more modern pieces put together over the years, and we know too. There's even a place where Gustav Holst is mentioned as being one of the composers is going to be offered in some of the performances too. And I also know too that this is all laid out in an interesting way, that the much of the way that it seems that with the way that is going to be presented at the concert fits into, in many cases, how World War One, I suppose, actually took place, with a mood that was set, with the events that happened before the hostilities began, during the experience of fighting and veterans' experiences, and now, of course, but how soldiers were experiencing the war at the time, and then once everything ended with Armistice Day, and then finally the signing of the Treaty of Versailles, what kind of hope there was for the future after World War One, which we now know history has borne out has not been very well, we understand.
Yes, that's right. Well, and you know, music is always an expression of what the composers and the poets or people who wrote the words felt at the time. And so, you know, war can be a very emotional experience, and if you're in the middle of it. And several of these composers and poets whose words are used in the song were veterans themselves. And so, you know, they're speaking from experience. And, of course, you know, they're just like everyone else. They're kind of ambivalent. I mean, sometimes, you know, you don't seek a war, but the war finds you, and you have to, you know, you're forced to actually do something and get involved. And you know, there's loss involved, and there's certainly, you know, love involved and other emotions. So that's what the composers had tried to portray.
And also, too, finally, we note here on the week of events that are tied to Armistice Day, the 100th anniversary of which is this year, that coming up on November 13th, there's going to be a dinner and a presentation that the Valparaiso University student chapter of IIEE is going to put on, talking about an engineering topic, which may not seem exciting, but certainly one that's going to draw attention, which is, I guess the title is The Ethics of Engineering Weapons of Mass Destruction. That's an interesting topic to bring up at this particular time, is it not?
Yes. So, again, you know, there's been an, I think, increasing focus in at least, you know, in certain circles about the ethics of, not the ethics of, well, the ethics of war in general, but mm-hmm. specifically, you know, what, because we know, for instance, that, you know, the Google employees had, you know, recently petitioned their company to stop working with the Defense Department on a certain military project because they thought it was not ethical. And so, you know, is it ethical for engineers to develop, you know, nuclear bombs? Or, you know, and another segment of that discussion has been, you know, what about artificial intelligence? You know, should we have robots be fighting each other on the battlefield? And what happens if they get out of control? You know, is that ethical? And so, you're right, it's a very interesting topic.
Well, certainly maybe you could offer some provoking thought, I suppose, which is the idea of having these projects like this, and certainly to be held at a university, at Valparaiso University in this particular instance. Well, Jeff Gettleman, thank you very much for spending time to talk with us, not only about the topic of this 100th anniversary of Armistice Day, its importance in the role of history, which we have learned over the years, this particular observance is going to fit in together, and how we've been able to turn it into a very important local event coming up in Valparaiso at the university, as well as the city of Valparaiso. And Jeff, thank you very much for spending time to explain all this to us here on Regionally Speaking today.
Yeah, well, thank you for giving me the opportunity to tell about it.
In spite of its awareness, a gender pay gap still exists everywhere in the state of Indiana, and Northwest Indiana specifically, one of the worst offenders. Lakeshore Public Radio, Sharon Jackson spoke recently with Kim Churches, the CEO of the American Association of University Women, about the problem and some solutions.
Can you tell us about the gender pay gap in Northwest Indiana?
I sure can. In fact, my mother resides in Northwest Indiana, so it's an area that I'm very, very familiar with. So basically, based on the new census data that was released last week, AUW took a gender slice to that data to really look at the nation, each state, and every congressional district. And as we look at Northwest Indiana, we find that women are earning roughly between 66 and 74% of what males are earning in full-time employment at the state as well. So this is alarming because it's actually below the national average. The national average shows that the gap is 80 cents on the dollar overall for women working full-time compared to their male counterparts working full-time in the United States.
And so it compares, it's a bad comparison because Northwest Indiana is a worst offender for unequal pay.
Yeah, it is. You're below the national average of the 80 cents on the dollar, which is concerning. And now there's some things that can be done. Indiana overall has what we consider weak state equal pay laws. Many, many states, in fact, there are 42 states this year, many times working in bipartisan efforts to put forward stronger equal pay laws, because this really becomes about economic security for families. This is not just about a women's rights issue. This is a human rights and family rights issue to ensure all have a wage matched to their skills and abilities.
So what's being done in Indiana to address this pay gap? Is there legislation being crafted to protect families, to wipe this problem out?
So not enough in our view. And in fact, our members and advocates on the ground in Indiana, I know, have been advocating and lobbying their elected leaders for more. So as an example, you know, an example of strong equal pay laws would be like those in states like California and Illinois, Maryland, Massachusetts, Oregon and Washington and others. In the state of Indiana, there are some really easy ones that could be passed that could truly help to ensure that the Equal Pay Act, which is now 55 years old and in need of updating, had some safety nets for all full-time working employees, and whether they're hourly or salaried in the state of Indiana. So one example would be a bill to prohibit using salary history in hiring. And why is that important? Because women are traditionally paid less than their male counterparts. And if you're applying for a new job and you're using former salaries as the guide to your future salary, that may have nothing to do with what the market will bear for the job that you're applying for. And so you can have bias against you just because you were paid less in your former job, even though the going rate may be higher in the job you're applying for. So by prohibiting using salary history in hiring, that can really help to level the playing field or at least start to close that pay gap.
Because what prospective new employers use your previous salary to bump you just barely higher? Is that what it is?
You got it. Or go to the lower end because you were making less. So say you're applying for a job that has a range of 60 to 70, but in your last job you were being paid 47. They might think they could get some savings out of you and offer you less than their low end. And that's how it just compounds and perpetuates the pay gap over time. And we're seeing in states that have passed more pay equity laws, actually that gap is starting to close. I will say pay equity laws in and of themselves are not enough to do everything because, you know, we've passed many laws in this country and we still have other issues around culture and societal needs to continuously improve. So we try to take a multi-pronged approach. We look at this of advocating for local, state, and federal equal pay laws and strengthening those laws, as we've been talking about. We want to work with employers in the nonprofit, educational sectors, and every industry, private and public in the nation, to help employers to improve their practices and their workplace cultures, working with them on ongoing training on things like pay audits to make sure that unconscious bias is not adding to the pay gap within their companies or organizations. And then last, we're aiming to train 10 million women in 5 years how to negotiate their own salaries and secure their own financial futures, because we believe that's the other part of a multi-pronged approach here, is to ensure women have the skills and tactics needed to negotiate on behalf of themselves.
Since this issue is pretty well known now, how come it hasn't been solved already, and what's standing in the way of it? The solution, yeah.
Yeah, it's a pretty sad state of affairs that I have to say that women on average, it's basically flat to last year, and we haven't made these vast improvements. Look, a lot of times women are concerned about advocating on behalf of themselves. They fear retribution or worse, or getting fired. I think that, you know, there are some implicit biases that all of us as human beings have, and sadly, even people who take an implicit bias test, we have 170,000 AEW members and advocates who are firmly behind our mission to advance gender equity, and yet some of us have implicit biases as to thinking what is a man's job versus a woman's job and what it's worth. And so we all have to be exceedingly mindful to get this fixed. Sadly, the improvements on the pay gap have only moved up by 5 cents, just a nickel, in the last 2 decades, and that's just not enough. So that's why we're doubling down at AUW and making a concerted effort over the next 5 years, and then we're hoping that we can close the pay gap by 2030 in our lifetime.
How can people help in your mission to close that gap?
So one is we'll be offering online, absolutely free salary negotiation course that you can take at AEUW.org at the end of this month. We also offer in-person workshops around the nation, and we're working in partnerships with mayors and governors in red, blue, and purple states, because this is about an economic security issue. Secondly, I think, you know, people, your listeners, can certainly think about and look at their own employee handbooks. What are their employers doing to ensure that women's voices are heard in this and are protected as they think about pay gaps? And if you're a hiring manager and you're looking at this, what are some things that you can do to improve workplace cultures and allow women to thrive in the same way that men have thrived? And then last is talking to your elected leaders. talking to your members of U.S. Congress and saying we need to pass the Paycheck Fairness Act, asking them to co-sponsor this act so that it can improve upon the Equal Pay Act. Talk to your state legislature about some of these additional bills that could be introduced, such as prohibiting using salary history or prohibiting job tracking based on sex, or passing a bill on including protected classes in addition to sex in bills so that people in the workplace can be protected.
I'm thinking about organizations, companies, you know, not wanting to pay more. What are we going to do about them? Because I'm sure that there's some parties that don't want to see this addressed because they don't want to part with more profits.
So here's the amazing thing. I think we both would agree that hiring and firing and attrition is very, very expensive. And the sad thing is that women just check out when they feel undervalued, their productivity, or they simply leave the company. And hiring, firing, and attrition rates are exceedingly expensive for any enterprise, whether it's a for-profit or nonprofit or educational institution, for lack of time, resources, et cetera. Actually, study after study has shown that when women are paid what their male counterparts are paid on the same skills and abilities, the ROI increases on every business line. The same is true for the leadership gap. And I would say that the pay gap and the leadership gap and seeing more women in seats throughout an organization's hierarchy actually leads to stronger return on investment, a better bottom line for every business line.
And what can we do as just people out here in the workforce to try to help solve the problem of the pay gap?
One, be aware of your own implicit bias. And there is a link on Harvard University's website for the implicit bias test. All of us, it's not to say that all biases, you know, some of them are protectionism that we use as human beings, but understanding and checking your own implicit bias at the door so that you are hiring and promoting and being colleagues with all humans in your workforce and not perpetuating old stereotypes. So that's one. Two, consider taking our salary negotiation course. It's completely free, and we want to empower women with more resources, whether you're an hourly wage earner or a salaried employee, to ensure that you're being paid what your skills and abilities are worth. And we've seen it's evidence-based, and we've seen women earning 15, 20, 25% more in their salaries once they've taken the course and renegotiated their salaries.
And where can you find that course?
You bet. You can find that course on our website at salary.aauw.org.
And that's going to be available at the end of the month?
It'll be an online module at the end of the month, totally free, and then will be released in Spanish as well in the following month. But right now, we're offering in-person workshops totally free as well all over the country, and there'll be a list of those on our website available too.
What about women who, and anybody for that matter, they're getting a new job and they don't want to price themselves out of a job, so they're afraid to ask for what they deserve?
Yeah, that's exactly what we teach them in the course. So it's not just a matter of the confidence-building skills of how to negotiate. Very importantly, what we're teaching you is about your marketplace, where you are in the geography, where you are on that job title, how it compares and contrasts with other jobs with those skills and abilities, so that you can have a range that you believe is your sweet spot, and you can negotiate much more carefully on that. So we're giving you the quants as well as the qualitative work in the workshop.
Is there anything else that you want to add that maybe I haven't asked you about?
No, I would say honestly that time's up on the pay gap, and this is about math. It's not about myth. And what we have to understand is that this pay gap is systemic in every geography, in every zip code, in every industry, at every range of our socioeconomic status. But we can do something about it with this multi-pronged approach.
Well, thank you so much. We've been talking with Kimberly Churches, the CEO of the American Association of University Women.
Lakeshore Public Radio's furry friend Ollie joins us in the studio now to answer your pet's questions on Ask Ollie. The pet questions are voiced by woman-human Victoria Baller, and Ollie's responses are voiced by man-human Tom Maloney. Ask Ollie is supported by the Humane Society of Northwest Indiana.
Dear Ollie, I'm writing you today about sugar. Sugar, a.k.a. Suga, one of your Maltese Shih Tzu mixed dogs that I adopted from the Humane Society of Northwest Indiana many, many years ago. She found her forever home with me. Getting old is not for sissies, even if you're a happy dog. Suga is now almost 14 years old. She loves the world like no one I ever knew. but she is deaf, and at the same time, she has lost most of her vision in her right eye. She did have an ulcer on that eye, which has been healed, but combined with a cataract, that affects her sight. Her temperament has changed, understandably, and she's disoriented at times. But I love her. I want nothing more than to give her a good old age and try to accept my limitations at that. I adore her and won't be surprised if she's still around for quite a while. That's what I hope. I just love that funny, smart, stubborn, beautiful, feisty little girl, and I can see her on the first day that she was adopted. And that is how I shall always remember her. For her short time on this earth, she lit up my life. I'm fortunate to have shared part of my life with this wonderful creature that has such a great capacity for devotion and love. Signed, Sharon Blessam, Pittsboro, North Carolina.
Dear Sharon, anyone who has struggled with the sadness of caring for an aging dog can relate to your sentiments. Aging in a dog is much like aging in a human being. Health issues abound, as they do with older humans. The average lifespan of a dog is about 10 to 12 years, so you've had Sugar longer than usual. Our executive director, Frida White, just lost her beloved dog, Bella, and she was 12. Don McAuliffe, one of our corporate supporters, lost his dog, Molly, in the same way she did, suddenly. Molly, too, appeared to be in good health and had just turned 13 years old. Unfortunately, death is an equal opportunity for both people and their pets. I guess I have to weigh in on this since I just celebrated my 13th birthday. I'm not as fast as I used to be, and I stumble when going down the stairs. I remember when my friend Oscar turned 14 and began to go downhill. I challenged him for the position of pack leader and made his life miserable. When Oscar died, I took the opportunity to step in and be the number one dog. I'm now large and in charge of all the other dogs in the residence and, of course, the kitchen. No, getting older is not for sissies, and I'd rather be like Peter Pan and never grow old, but that's not the plan. So I enjoy my dinner, afternoon snacks, my walks in the Gabus Arboretum, rides in the car to get puppy cups from Culver's or whipped cream from Starbucks, and running the show here. I also have an apprentice writer who will take over for me when I'm gone. His name is Freddie, and he has a lot to learn. But he's a quick study, though I won't ever tell him that. He doesn't text, but he can write and will keep things going, so to speak. Good luck to you and Sugar, and appreciate every day you have together. Life is short for us dogs. Signed, your friend in fur, Ollie. Love is a four-letter word.
And if you have a question for your friend in fur, Ollie, you can email it to ollie@lakeshorepublicmedia.org. Ask Ollie is supported by the Humane Society of Northwest Indiana. That's it for Regionally Speaking for today. I'm Chris Nolte. Thank you for joining us and hope you'll be with us tomorrow for Reporters Roundtable Thursday. We'll have from the Post Tribune, Meredith Coleus-Pete and Carol Carlson, and from the Times, reporters Andrew Steele and Joseph Pete.